It's not like we can just say you can do anything and it's all fine. We know that the way people behave is partly to do with punishments and rewards and incentives and disincentives. And so those fundamental sort of behaviourist approaches can be applied to climate change. We should be penalising people who are polluting. We should be rewarding people that are not polluting.
Hello, welcome to Your Brain on Climate. I'm Dave. Lovely to be talking to you again. And this month, and next month actually, this month to start with, we're going to be looking at possibly the thorniest issue of the lot. Why do we behave? Why do we do the things that we do? Why is it that we bugger up the planet without meaning to? In loads of little ways, in big ways. These patterns of behaviour that we've got where we just kind of do things. I do things all the time and I don't think about them things. Well, why? Why do I behave the way I behave? And how can I behave different? Is behaviour the right way of looking at it? Am I really in any sort of way in charge of what I do and how I act in the world? The carbon that I emit, is it all systems? Is it all structures? Is climate change too big for any of that? And are we all trapped in the machine? Or can we be doing things about it? Can we smash our own synaptic shortcuts? And can we make ourselves behave as if we only had one place in the universe we could live? Well, joining me this month on Your Brain on Climate is the majestic Professor Lorraine Whitmarsh, Professor of Environmental Psychology at the University of Bath and Director of the Centre for Climate and Social Transformations. What are extremely good things? And she has an extremely large brain. And we talked about behaviour change. You will often hear it said that we, the great wash of we, we'll come to we next episode, we need to change our behaviour and there is something wrong with the way we behave, as if we are all children, naughty children. And what needs to happen is that we need to have our bottoms smacked. Well, I asked Lorraine all about that. She's an expert in behaviour change. That is her thing. And we talked about why people behave the way they behave, all the different types of things that are used to get people to act differently in the world when it comes to climate change, which of them work. And we get into some stuff that is where the juice really flows, in my opinion, about like free will. Are we actually really in control of any of this stuff? If we woke up tomorrow morning and said, right, I decide I am not going to behave in a way what is bad for the planet, can I do that? Do I even understand the ways in which I behave, what I think, what I desire? This, my friends, is what this podcast was here for. And we're going to talk all about that. So strap yourself in. As always, if you like what you hear, please do consider chucking me a couple of quid on Patreon, www.patreon.com/yourbrainonclimate. Huge thanks to those people who do. Episodes only come out once a month because I haven't got more time, but your support helps me pay for guests. I pay for my guests. Hardly any podcasts pay for their guests. I do it because I think it's important to respect their time and it enables me to have great chats with interesting people. So please do that. And if you can't and won't do that, you can go to your podcast medium of choice, iTunes, Spotify, give it a review, write something with your hands, give us a star rating, please. And you can do the socials. I'm on Twitter, X thing, at Brain Climate. I've also got now a Substack, which is Substack, whatever it is, Your Brain on Climate, which I will probably neglect like all my other socials, but this one, at least for now, is going to have some stuff on it that is supplementary to the episode and other things that I think as well, so go and check that out. And as always, if you hear this noise, it denotes wisdom. It means that someone, probably Lorraine, has said something interesting, and rather than stop the podcast and Google it or worry about it, you can just go back and check it out later, because I'll put a little linky in the show notes. Right, okay, on with it. And we spoke on a Friday afternoon when I had just interrupted Lorraine behaving very badly indeed.
Your brain on climate.
Dave, I just had a cheese sandwich and I feel a little bit of guilt about that because cheese is so bad for climate change. And I always get, my dairy guilt has kicked in.
Oh, so you've been behaving wickedly.
I have, absolutely, yeah. In some ways, I feel like, I'm virtuous. Sometimes I do good things for climate, but I often do not and I feel bad.
Right, we're going to talk about that. We're going to come to that. And a very, very well done, by the way, getting out of the way nice and early that you are an evil planet-destroying hypocrite, just like everybody else. So don't be writing to Lorraine. So we're going to talk about behaviour change, which is your thing, right? And I just want to, what the hell even does that mean? So if I say to you, like, we need to change our behaviour, unpick that sentence to me. What is behaviour?
Well, behaviour are the things that we do. They are actions we take. And it can be helpful to contrast that with our thoughts and feelings, our beliefs and attitudes, stuff that's going on in our head. So behaviour is usually something that we can see people doing. And in the context of climate change, the other thing to say is that it isn't just about stuff we buy. So quite often when we say you've got to change your behaviour to tackle climate change, the things that people will quite often think about are, oh, does that mean I have to buy a heat pump? Or does that mean I have to do even more recycling? So kind of it's to do with the consumption. Now, those sorts of things are really important behaviours that we can take. Definitely, there are things that will directly reduce our carbon footprint. But they're not the only types of behaviour that we can take. They are just one example. There are also things that we can do in the workplace as professionals. There are things that we can do in the communities that we live in and with our sort of family and friends. There are things that we can do as investors, as citizens. We can vote or protest in lots of different ways. So
we can smash things. That's behaviour.
You could smash things. I'm not endorsing that, but a person could smash a thing. Yeah.
So the point being, I guess, that it's all very well giving a shit about climate change, and we need to give a shit, but kind of climate change is caused by the stuff that happens in the real world, a large chunk of which happens because of us, our behavior.
Exactly. So in fact, most of the things we need to get to our carbon targets, our net zero targets, will require behaviour change. Some people might actually say all of the things, actually, because the Climate Change Committee, which is the government's advisors on climate change, have estimated that something like about 60% of the measures needed to get to net zero will need to involve behaviour change by consumers. So that's things like buying electric vehicles or heat pumps and maybe changing our diets and things like that. But the rest of the wedge, the 40% that remains, will also involve behaviour change, but by people in business primarily. So there will be about, you know, what technologies are we using, how are we supplying and providing energy and all of that stuff. So across the board, actually, behaviour change comes in. So, yeah, it's absolutely fundamental to tackling climate change.
Max the Little Monster left the lights on and blared the TV, even when he wasn't in the room. No big whoop, said Max. The one night in the middle of his...
When I talk about behaviour change, it all sounds a little bit kind of school behaviour, schoolish, naughty children behaving. There's something about, I think I'm thinking back to being a kid and thinking about you've behaved very badly. Is there something about the framing of behaviour change that's a bit of a problem, do you think? It kind of like when you're talking, I'm sort of a little bit of me is thinking like behaviour is a strange concept, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose that's true. We think about sort of behavioural problems, don't we? And so I think it does get sort of like associated with a kind of top down. We've got a particular behaviour in mind and right, you're maybe deviating from that. So, I mean, there is an element of truth in that, because if you look at where our emissions come from, there are some behaviours that are really high emitting and there are some that are really low emitting. So there are some behaviours that are particularly bad for climate change, but that doesn't necessarily mean we need to blame individuals for taking those actions, because actually we're very often constrained in the choices that we have. So well, the example of eating a cheese sandwich is not a great one, actually, because I could have just chosen a vegan sandwich. But in other cases, like getting to work, Some people might not have great public transport or cycling options. They might actually, driving might be realistically the only option for them. So there are constraints that people have. There are price constraints. There are lots of reasons why. It's often really difficult to take a low carbon action, even if we know what that action is, which sometimes we don't. That's right. I think sort of thinking about behaviour doesn't necessarily mean we need to blame the individual. It's just about understanding where we might intervene to shape that behaviour. And it isn't necessarily about telling people what to do, telling them off if they're doing the wrong thing. It might be about creating an environment that enables people to do the right thing.
Although sometimes if your mum comes and says, "Oi, bloody well stop it," that can be quite an effective way to change your behaviour. Maybe I need to talk to someone about my mummy related take on this issue.
No, but you're getting at something, which is that it's not like we can just say you can do anything and it's all fine. We know that the way people behave is partly to do with punishments and rewards and incentives and disincentives. And so those fundamental sort of behaviourist approaches can be applied to climate change. We should be penalising people who are polluting. We should be rewarding people that are not polluting. Those are fundamental behavioural principles that we can apply here. And at the moment, we're not really doing that. Actually, you can get away with buying a cheese sandwich and actually quite enjoying it. So that needs to change.
All right. Okay. So we're going to get into all of that, but I want to take it back a step or two, kind of to the basic level, right? As squishy, confused bags of water, which is what humans are, why do we behave, if behavior means kind of the things we do in the world, in particular ways at all? What do you think determines those grooves that we kind of settle down into?
Yeah. So there are things sort of inside us, in our brains, for example, in our bodies, that partly drive what we do. We're hungry, we look for food, etc. We feel very strongly about something. I have a really strong kind of compulsion to go and protest about something. I might go and do that. So those might be things that are coming from within us. They might be thoughts, feelings, even sort of biological drives. Those are partly what drives our behaviour, but they're definitely not the only things. And at least as much of the causes of our behaviour come from the world around us. So that's other people, the physical environment, prices, kind of social norms and things like that. And so we're absolutely a product of the context in which we live, at least as much as what we're kind of thinking and feeling. And sometimes that we don't actually realise that, because we know from psychological research, if you ask people, why did you do that? They will say, oh, because I felt strongly about it, or I wanted to do that, or because I know that's the right thing to do. That they'll often sort of attribute their behaviour to internal causes. And actually, what we know from quite sort of clever studies is that often the causes are much more to do with, well, actually, it was because the people around them were very visibly doing that thing, so you just sort of conformed, didn't you? Or because the physical environment sort of drove you to that sort of action, and so on. And so we actually know it is stuff around us, but we're not necessarily really aware of those things. So that sort of does make it a little bit more complex trying to figure out the causes of our behaviour, because we can't only rely on asking people why they did things.
And habits as well, I guess. Like, we just kind of behave in a certain way and that's what we do. Like, we might have cheese sandwiches for lunch on a Friday all the time, and that's just our little treat to ourselves.
You have so got it right, Dave. You have no idea. Habits are a massive driver of our behaviour. And actually, in psychology, a lot of our theories are not very well designed to account for habits. We sort of quite often assume there is a conscious process of deliberating over a course of action, and, you know, weighing up pros and cons and then taking an action. Sometimes that's what we do over, you know, thinking about, say, maybe buying a type of car. You will look at sort of different options, weigh up the pros and cons, the prices and all the rest, maybe ask a few people, and then reach a decision. But the majority of our behaviour is not like that. It's much more habitual, and it's actually a product of, again, the context in which we live. So we have, it's 8 o'clock in the morning. It's a weekday. I'm just going to get the car keys out, leave the house, drive to work. I'm not going to think about, shall I take the bus today? What route shall I walk or cycle? You know, you're not going to think about all those different options. You're going to take the mode of transport that you always do. And so the context quite quickly starts to drive your behaviour when it's stable, and so that's where habits come in. And those are quite difficult to change as well. It's quite difficult to change behaviours that have become entrenched like that.
So there's a mixture. I'm hearing kind of a mixture of like association. So we, you know, it's 11 o'clock. You have a cup of coffee. I found myself definitely making coffee sometimes without at any point feeling like I've consciously willed myself to get up and do it. I've just sat mm-hmm. down again and I've got a coffee and I've mm-hmm. suddenly checked in. But then there's also, I suppose, all of the kind of ways in which I make that coffee, which I'm not thinking about either. Like, and where I put the fridge back. I'm things back in the fridge, and I'm thinking of that Seinfeld joke about when you go in the shower, everyone always washes themselves in the same order. Like mm-hmm, every day mm-hmm. you wash your bits in the same order. So there's so much kind of habitual behavioural stuff, really at a deep level we're not thinking about at all, right?
Very much so. So I think, so habits kind of operate at a couple of different levels. There's the, as you say, kind of the trigger to actually do something, whether that's like, it's 8 o'clock, I leave the house to go to work. But then there's the sequence of events that kind of follow, and all of that can be very habitual as well. So it absolutely, it makes it really difficult to then kind of actually disentangle, because it may be that your habit has become sort of actually somewhat removed from your attitudes. So actually, yeah, I do just habitually kind of get my cheese sandwich on a Friday, but my God, am I aware that that's a bad thing? But somehow I just find myself doing it. So yeah, you may have become much more educated and concerned about something in the meantime, but that's not yet translated into behaviour change.
So, right, okay, this is good. So I heard four different things, at least, that sort of determine how we behave. We've got habits, and just it's what we have always done. We've got kind of what people around us do. So what is expected of us, you know, we don't see anyone else doing something, so we don't do it either, or vice versa. And that's, I suppose that one explains things like when you walk past a bin and it's already overflowing. Mm-hmm. And then you can see loads of stuff that people have just chucked their stuff on the floor around it, right? Because they've gone, well, that's all right. That's already overflowing. There's clearly not a problem with putting more stuff onto the floor around that bin. Mm-hmm. You've got stuff like what's available to you. So you can't have a habit to take the bus if there's no bus for you to take, for mm-hmm. example. And then the little residual bit of it that's left seems to be free will. So actually, like, what we want or what we think we want. And I guess even that may not even be what we really want anyway, right?
I think that's right, because I think even what you think you want will be kind of like socially constructed to some extent, and a product of things like prices, economic processes, and various other sort of probably convenience factors, which are also to do with the physical environment. So, yeah, and a good example of that, I think, is the fact that people think that buying more stuff, getting a bigger house, going abroad on holidays, all those things which tend to be quite high carbon, will make them happy. We've been sort of sold that lie, actually, through marketing and advertising and so on, that myth of consumption. But in actual fact, we know that isn't the case. In fact, people with materialistic lifestyles tend to be less happy. So even when we think, oh, well, that's the bit that's really me, I really want that, even if I can't enact it because I don't have enough money, let's say, to go abroad or something. Well, in fact, that is coming probably from some adverts or some social norms that you've not necessarily just come up with on your own.
Advertising is based on one thing: happiness. And you know what happiness is? Happiness is the smell of a new car. It's freedom from fear. It's a billboard on the side of the road that screams with reassurance that whatever you're doing, it's okay.
So is there any bit of this that is kind of us actually just behaving in particular ways because we decide we want to, do you think?
I think that would be really hard to identify, because even if you sort of had some sort of ideas that really went against social norms, they would be coming from somewhere. They would be due to something that you've read or some experience that you've had. But I don't think that's necessarily a problem. I think it's simply about being aware that we are influenced by all these different things, and that when you are exposed a lot to adverts that encourage you to consume, but on the other hand, you're told that consumption is in different ways maybe bad for the environment, how do you weigh up those different pieces of information? How do you make sense, and what do you decide to do about it? So yeah, I don't think it's a problem that all of these there are multiple influences on our behavior. It's kind of, we still have some degree of choice, even within those constraints.
So what do you think then of, and maybe you could explain for the listeners, the concept of nudging? So the idea of, you explain it. Tell the class what it is, and then whether or not you think it's awful.
So nudging is the idea that you can change people's behaviour a bit sort of beneath the radar. So without them maybe being aware of it, and usually by changing the choice environment in which they find themselves. And so in contrast to having a lesson, so actual formal education, being told something, and then maybe you think about it and then you act on it or not, nudging is more about things like product placement. You know, just in the supermarket, it's a bit more visible. And so somehow your eye catches it and oh, actually, yeah, I will have that today. Or, you know, they know that you're hungry when you get to the checkout and suddenly there's some chocolate bars there.
If they put the cheese sandwich on a slightly higher shelf, maybe you wouldn't have bought it.
Completely. That? Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Because I'm only 5 foot tall. So that would completely take that option away from me. So, yeah. So you can physically change the environment. You can use things like defaults. So in some of the clever experiments, it's about kind of, you know, the box is already ticked for you and you have to untick it on a particular form or whatever in order to then opt out. But people either don't notice it or they just can't be bothered or whatever. And so people end up getting, this is where you end up getting on so many email lists, because you didn't spot that opt-out thing. So defaults are very powerful, and they can be used for sort of good or bad. Social norms, you know, are often seen as a sort of nudge, in that if you sort of convey the idea that something is very normal, then again, without people really realizing it, they will sort of tend to conform to that norm as well. So there are, these things are sort of going on under the radar, playing on these kind of biases and sort of unconscious processes that we have that influence our decision making, and sort of nudge us in a particular direction.
And some people think nudging is the devil, if I understand it right, because they think it's kind of just about tricking people into changing small behaviours instead of, e.g., smashing capitalism. What do you reckon about that?
I don't completely agree with that. I think nudging has a place to play, a place. Nudging has a place. So I would say that it's definitely true that we need to engage the public with climate change much more in a very explicit way, and not hide the fact that we're going to need radical changes to society and to people's lifestyles. And in order for that to happen, we need to have consent. We need to bring people with us. So that is about explicitly having conversations about what does climate change mean? How can we reach net zero in a way that will work with you and in ways that are fair and effective and so on. But once we've got that broad consent about the direction of change, I think nudging is one of the most powerful tools in the sort of behaviour change toolbox, because it's really about making it easy for people to do the right thing, the default, the automatic, the obvious choice. And so it doesn't require, you know, massive cognitive effort or physical effort or economic effort for people to do the right thing. It's already the obvious choice. And so why not design societies around that, as long as those nudges are the sort of sustainable nudges? And I've seen some really nice experiments which do this. So there was a great one in Austria, I think, where they moved people onto a green energy tariff by default. And by doing that, all of their energy was coming from renewable sources. They did pay slightly more for it, but they could opt out and have a fossil tariff at a lower price, but hardly anybody did, actually. So you had about 80 to 90% of customers, and this was millions of people, who actually stayed on a green energy tariff. And it's just playing with the idea that people will just, that they are fundamentally a bit lazy, you could say. You know, they go with the easy option. And so why not use that in favour of a sustainable society?
Well, use it for good, right? Because I definitely got I got all cross at a beer company who I shall not name, but, you know, an online beer subscription company who I did an order with. And then in order to cancel it, you have to call them up. You can sign up in a second, but to cancel it, you have to call them up. And I did, because I'm stubborn, but I thought, I bet so many people don't. So many people don't. And so they stay getting subscribed. Yeah. And all of this stuff is being used around us all over the place, isn't it? To kind of trick us. It's called sludging. I learned this. Like using nudges for ill is called a sludge.
That's right.
So we need to smash that as well, by the sound of it. So I'm all about smashing things on this podcast.
Yeah. No, I'm with you. Yeah. The free trial is, it's always a hook that plays on that sort of that, the laziness that we have. Yeah.
Your brain on climate.
Righto, okay, so let's talk about the planet and how we behave, change our way out of this. So look, I'm with you. I've had a go at you about your cheese sandwich, but I reckon number of things I've done today that comply with my belief that climate change is bad is probably zero. I've definitely got the heating on a little bit more than I need it because I'm cold. I haven't otherwise really thought about it. And I say I care about climate change, but I wouldn't say I behave like it in loads of ways. Not me necessarily, but why don't we? What is that gap between what we believe and how we behave?
So, yeah, this gap is referred to in various different ways, either as the value action gap or the attitude behavior gap, but it's everywhere, and everybody has a gap to some extent. And it's really because of what we said at the beginning, which is that our behavior is partly influenced by what we think and feel, for example, our concern about climate change, but in a very large part, it's about the world around us and how much does it cost? Is it convenient? What are other people doing? And so on. And because those things are often aligned to higher carbon choices, we end up actually finding it very difficult to do the right thing, even when we know what the right thing is. And it is worth saying that we don't always know exactly what is the right thing to do, because our research shows that when we ask people, what are you doing to tackle climate change? And even what do you think is effective to tackle climate change? Things like recycling and bringing your own reusable cup to the cafe or...
Too late. Don't be trying to hold your reusable cup up.
Your name is at Starbucks. Oh, God.
Yeah, there we are. It's Starbucks. And you eat cheese on a Friday. So you can just... Yeah,
I know. Exactly. So this is a drop in the ocean, this reusable cup, compared to that cheese sandwich. But a lot of people don't realise that. They think, I've recycled, I've brought my carrier bag to the supermarket. That's I've done my bit. And so it's fine for me to fly on holiday or to drive a petrol vehicle or to have a cheese sandwich. When actually those things, driving, flying, eating red meat and dairy, are some of the most... climate impactful things that we do. They really have very high carbon footprints, and actually there isn't very good awareness of this. So sometimes there is a knowledge gap. So sometimes that's why we don't act in line with, you know, wanting to tackle climate change. But quite often it is about the price, the inconvenience, the social norm, and those are difficult things to change, to align our actions with our values.
And I guess so much of this is about the way normal life just carries on, right? Like in normal life, we have all this stuff that we do, and then climate is and environment stuff is kind of coming at us from the side. It's not really necessarily part of the soup that we swim in, is it?
I think that's right. Yeah, exactly. I think it's very easy to sort of forget about climate change on a day-to-day basis. And we know from studies that it's sort of psychologically distant. So it's sort of seen as something that's kind of more of a future problem. So it's far off in time, that it's kind of geographically distant. Well, it's mostly affecting people in developing countries, isn't it? And that it's sort of affecting other people. And it sort of seems uncertain as well in many ways. So there are lots of reasons why psychologically it's just not in our face, whereas things like, you know, I'm hungry, I'm, you know, and how much does this cost and how cold am I? I'm just going to turn on the heat. And these are things that are really immediate concerns that we're going to act on. And we might not necessarily even think about climate change in those day-to-day choices.
Change. Well, there's so much we can do about it, I suppose, in terms of ecologically assisting with our lifestyle, you know, which I think possibly I do in small ways. I mean, climate change is occurring because of, what, holes in the ozone layer? Are we causing that?
You talked a bit there about the some types of activity, flying, eating cheese sandwiches on a Friday, driving, have got higher carbon impact than some other ones. So, and would you say, this is a bit of an unfair question, but would you say some behaviour needs changing more than other types of behaviour? Do some people behave worse? To get all school mistressly about it for a second.
Well, I think those are two separate things, actually, because yes, there are definitely some behaviours that are worse than others. So driving, flying, eating red meat and dairy, heating our home with gas, those would be the top few things that are really bad. And yet also there are some people that are worse, it turns out, because the biggest predictor of carbon footprint is income. So people on the top incomes have a carbon footprint several times the size of people on the lowest incomes. And it's to do with, you know, it's consumption. If you can afford a big house and you know, a big car and to go away on holiday a lot, you are going to be spending that money on doing those sorts of things. And so it tends to be that people on the highest income have the biggest carbon footprint. And you can think about that also globally. The richest countries have bigger carbon footprints on average than the poorest countries. So there are some people that need to change a lot more than other people.
Yeah, it feels right, doesn't it? Because I've had a load of conversations in the course of my climate job with people who don't have much money, who say, bugger off. Like, you know, the idea that I need to change my behaviour when firstly, probably live quite a low carbon life anyway, but also more at the point I've got all this other stuff to care about. And then they will immediately go, and also what about these bastards over here doing all of this stuff? And that feels right. It's not about everybody having to radically change what they do.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've touched on something there, which we've also found really consistently, which is that fairness is such an important predictor of policies to tackle climate change. That people will accept policies if they are seen to be fair. And when it comes to things like frequent flyer levies, for example, that is seen to be quite fair because, of course, the people that are flying the most are doing the most polluting. So they should be the ones that have to pay more for that privilege. So you can sort of see why there would be resistance then to, well, there is a blanket tax on red meat, let's say. Well, of course, then the rich people can continue to eat their steaks and because they can afford to pay that tax. And yet that tax falls heavily on the poorest who can't afford. So I can absolutely understand that reaction. And in actual fact, if you look at some of the kind of solutions to tackle climate change, they, if done in the right way, they will actually address some of those issues like fuel poverty. So if we did insulate people's homes, there are ways in which you can do that would actually benefit poorer people. So we do need to be finding those solutions that are fairest, because not only are they going to be quite effective, but they are going to be more acceptable.
It feels like also we're getting into something that might make this all a bit difficult, which is about like freedom, right? And the idea, particularly maybe more on the right of politics, that there's no particular interest in doing things that restrict people's freedom of choice or freedom to act how they want. But it sounds like a large part of what you're talking about is essentially about doing that in some way. So how do you square that?
I think that's right, that we cannot have unrestricted freedoms in any context. I mean, it's not just about climate change. Of course, we have to have laws that mean that it's about balancing the rights of the individual with the responsibilities of living in a society and protecting other people. And if we took that seriously when it came to climate change, it would mean that people that have the biggest carbon footprint and the most ability to respond to climate change should be doing more to protect the people that haven't even caused climate change and that are feeling the worst effects of climate change. That there is something about that that we should be addressing head on, I think. And it does mean that we are going to have to limit some of our freedoms, at least. We do know that the more restrictive policies are, the less popular ones. But I think, as I say, if they can also be designed in a way that improve quality of life for people. And it is about explaining that some of those changes can be beneficial, even if we think that they might be about sacrifice. And again, it comes partly back to this idea of the myth of consumption. We're sold a lie that the more we consume, the happier we're going to be. And we know that that's not true. Actually, it's about sort of saying, well, let's think about what really does make us happy and finding ways to achieve that in lower carbon ways. And that is definitely possible to do. But yes, you're right. We need to be really having an honest conversation about what's the right balance between individual freedom and the responsibility to look after vulnerable people in society.
Yeah, and it all gets back a bit, I think, to people, back to the nudging conversation a little bit, but to people who go, like, the problem here is not how individuals do or don't behave. Instead, what you want to do is make the oil companies do better things and stuff like that. And I guess what you were saying earlier is it's not binary like that. You need both those things, right?
Absolutely, yeah. So we and Climate Outreach talk a lot about sort of individual change and system change being sort of two sides of the same coin, basically, because if you think about behavior change actually spanning a whole range of contexts, including the professional context, for example, and our roles as citizens, you know, there are things we can do to engage in system change by voting, protesting, making decisions at work that start to change the system and make it generally easier for people to do the right thing, as well as taking actions as an individual to reduce your carbon footprint. And the more we do those things, you know, we can start to change the system. The system itself, of course, then does constrain our behavioural options. So we need both of these things, but acknowledging that our behaviour is constrained by the system does not mean that we do not need individuals and groups of people to act differently. Absolutely, we need that as to be a part of the system change and to create it.
Bloody academics. Whenever I talk to academics, they always make stuff complicated. No one ever comes on here and says, the only thing you need to do is this one thing. They always say, no, unfortunately, Dave, you have to think of several things all at the same time.
And well, those people that say there's one thing are usually terrible human beings, I have to say. So.
From this evening, I must give the British people a very simple instruction. You must stay at home. Because the
I tell you a time recently when our behaviour changed, and that was when the Prime Minister of Great Britain and Northern Ireland went on the telly and said, you've all got to stay at home. And we did. And not only did we all stay at home, but we all started to treat other people as if they already had a virus, and we got all judgy about it, and we banged saucepans out of the window. And an alien or a cat who was looking at what we were doing would have gone, why has everyone started to behave really weirdly? What was going on there in terms of what were the main things that made behavior change en masse, and what, if any of that, can we learn for doing stuff about things like climate change?
That is a really great example of how you can do behavior change well as a government, which we're not yet seeing applied to climate change. But what happened there really was there was a very, very clear signal from the highest possible level that we have an emergency. This is as serious as it gets. And accompanying that very clear message was clear behavioural advice, stay at home, keep your distance, wash your hands, and slogans that went with that. And there was clear signage everywhere. There was information. You could not move for this very consistent, clear message everywhere you went. Along with the informational environment, you also had the economic aspects. You know, there was the furlough scheme, there were penalties, financial penalties if you broke the rules. So those kind of incentives and disincentives were brought into play as well. And the nature of the risk was also very visceral for people. You just had to turn on the TV and you would see people in hospital. You just had to go outside your house or pick up the phone. There would be people that were contracting this disease and feeling extremely ill. And there was a genuine fear people had about contracting this illness themselves. So there was a desire to protect other people, but also a very self-interested desire not to catch it as well. So, and even if you were doubtful about, well, is it really that serious? All of these kind of extrinsic things, like you would get fined if you broke the rules, just meant you conformed. And actually people could see other people conforming. So the social norm was there to do the right thing. So all of these factors are really sort of classic. Like you had the economic, the social, the informational, the leadership. It was all coming to play in together in a consistent way to really lock in the behaviour change that we needed. And you didn't have there very many people actually diverging from that the behavior that we wanted. So it was a sort of really good casebook study, I think, of how to change behavior.
Yeah, I can think of one or two individuals that diverged from it, but we don't need to get political. So going back to that, what we were talking about earlier, it kind of ticked all those boxes of what causes the grooves of behaviour in the first place. There was the sort of structural thing, so just making it easier to stay at home and or hit you with a stick if you don't. And you had that kind of emotional desire and the story that you wanted to do it and our fears and our solidarity for other people. And then we started to see everyone else doing it and that sort of changed the rule around us really quick. And I guess all of that just cut into what normal is and how we normally behave. And so even probably a lot of our habits might have changed. Because they maybe couldn't do them anymore.
Yeah, no, oh, absolutely. And I guess, I mean, you mentioned narratives as well. I mean, of course, the hero of the story was the NHS. And in this country, like, we worship the NHS. And here was a real opportunity to just see those wonderful doctors and nurses doing the good things that they do. And they were saving the day, really. So it was a narrative that we could all buy into. And there was no sort of, well, does it really exist? I don't see any evidence of it existing. It was like really in your face. So yeah, it all came together, I think.
And there are people who would say, we need that for climate change. Like, we need to scare people and motivate them in a really deep emotional story from the heart of government right now. And we need, you know, massive financial transfers to enable people to quit their high carbon jobs and et cetera, et cetera. We need all of that stuff. But we don't have it. We don't have that. So how come we can have it for a virus and we can't have it for climate change?
I would say, while it was a sort of textbook study of how to change behaviour, of course it had massive drawbacks and negative side effects because, you know, huge job losses, colossal impact on the economy, you know, really negative mental health impacts of people sort of being isolated, all the rest. So it's not like it wasn't without its problems. So while it was a really quick way and effective way of changing behaviour, we can take the lessons of how to do that and translate it into climate change in a way that hopefully minimises those negative impacts. So we think about how can we have a just transition in climate change? How can we avoid colossal job losses in animal agriculture or in the fossil fuel industry, those sort of high carbon industries? How can we bring those people, reskill those people and think about new jobs in the green economy and not have massive economic losses? And the analysis suggests that actually we can, it can be a really good economic opportunity if we embrace the green economy. So it's not about a direct transfer and doing this overnight and sort of locking in people, etc., in their homes. We do need to bring people with us as well, do this in a fair way. So yeah, we did write a paper a couple of years ago about, you know, that sort of, how can you bring the lessons of climate change and bring the lessons of COVID into climate change? And it's not exactly translating it, it's doing it in a way that is more considered, fair, etc.
Okay, so I guess the last question I've got, and we're going to talk about your cheese sandwich again, is about going easy on ourselves or not. because there is an element, by the sound of it, of all of this that is just, we're a bit lazy. I'm not saying you're lazy. We like cheese. And is that all right? Like, how important is it to kind of force ourselves to change our behavior a bit where we can? Is being a bit lazy, does that make us a bit lazy in other ways, which means the system never changes because it's full of lazy people? What I'm saying is this all your fault in a roundabout way?
Dave. I don't quite know what the right answer to that is, but I'll give you my opinion, which is that there are people who are just compelled to do the right thing even when it absolutely crushes them and takes, you know, and destroys them. And that sort of burnout can really come from people working in the environmental sector, for example. And, you know, they're just campaigning and they don't necessarily take time to look after themselves and take a break and, you know, maybe have a cheese sandwich occasionally. And I think those people are absolutely wonderful for their commitment and sacrifice. But obviously, it is about doing that in a way that is sustainable and looks after the mental health of that person. And we've done a little bit of work on kind of climate anxiety, and climate anxiety and taking sustainable behaviour are, you know, go hand in hand. Actually, the people that are the most climate anxious are already doing quite a lot on climate change. And it might be about that is the reason they're doing that is because they're driven by that anxiety. But how can we ensure that the anxiety doesn't take over because they're not seeing their behaviour as being as effective as it could be, for example? So I think it is about giving yourself a break sometimes and also finding support from like-minded people. So we know that one of the best ways to sort of address anxiety is to have social support, to speak to other people. And in the climate context, it's probably about actually joining a group that, of people that are also worried about climate change and want to do their bit. And it's partly about that social support, but it is also about then as a group, you're probably going to be more effective than as an individual. So that those are the sorts of things that then you can maybe think, okay, maybe I can do this sustainably because I'm part of a group. So I don't want to justify really my choice to have a cheese sandwich, but on a Friday, sometimes I just feel like I need a treat, Dave.
All right, very good. You're allowed your cheese sandwich. Thank you so much, Lorraine, for coming on Your Brain on Climate. What's the best way for people to follow you on the socials, find out what you're up to, all that sort of stuff?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter, so at L Whitmarsh, I think. Oh God,
you'll find me.
I'm on the web. Yeah.
Yeah, very good. Thanks, Lorraine. Right. Brilliant. Thank you, Lorraine. Thank you so much for coming on here. Check out Lorraine's work. Check out her studies. It's all really interesting. And she is great. And if you enjoyed that, consider it the first in a two-parter. The next episode, we're going to be looking almost down the other end of the telescope. With Lorraine, we talked a lot about things like nudging and day-to-day behaviours. And the next one is going to be looking at collective behaviour change and if such a thing is even possible and how you get it. Does it make any sense to talk about the we should do something? Does that mean anything at all? And actually, when it comes to climate change, is it right to even think of ourselves as individuals at all? That is with the majestic Jonathan Rowson. I've already done that record and you can listen to it round about Christmas time. So do pop back and check that out. And please, a reminder, if you like what you heard, the usual mechanisms apply. 5-star review, please, 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 please do that. Go on, please do that, please. Review with your hands or spread the word, tell people, put nice things everywhere. Oh, I'd love it if you were nice about me in public. I really would. Drop me an email to hello@yourbrainonclimate.com. Find me on the socials at Brain Climate. Check out the Substack at Your Brain on Climate. And in general, look after yourself. Behave very well, you naughty so-and-sos. Yes, you. I'm talking to you. And don't you be coming around here with your mummy issues, all right? Okay, bye.